my beloved listeners may recall The Big Questions, a couple of television series I did with Paul Davies, which also resulted in a couple of books. And I remember I was driving somewhere with Paul and he looked at me sadly and said, only about three people on earth know what I'm talking about. And he said it with a mixture of sadness and I think a hint of pride. Well, I was certainly not one of the three people who understood, and even at the end of two television series and two books, I was still totally bewildered by science. It's so damned counterintuitive. But to some extent, I blame it on my poor science education. Well, with so many Damoclean swords dangling overhead, with the great challenges we face as a species, most particularly, of course, climate change, there's never been a greater need for a well-thought-out approach to science education that would improve the way science is taught in schools and perhaps enhance the communication skills of professional scientists. Now, my next guest thinks we need to look very seriously at the way science is taught. Indeed, he's proposing we take a scientific approach to science education. He's very well placed to make these suggestions. He won the Carnegie Foundation's US University Professor of the Year Award in 2004. And in 2001, a little bauble called the Nobel Prize in Physics. He currently directs the Carl Wieman Science Education Initiative at the University of British Columbia and the Colorado Science Education Initiative. And he's been giving talks on the subject at a few Australian universities and now joins me from Melbourne. Carl, welcome to our little wireless program. What's wrong with science education?
The problem with science education is it's still being taught the same way it was in medieval times, and just as science wasn't done very effectively then, the education wasn't, and science has improved dramatically, but the education really hasn't. It's been kind of done by tradition and superstition.
I understand you had a eureka moment when you were teaching a graduate physics class. You thought you were pretty good at it, and then you twigged that you weren't, or rather that the students weren't getting it.
I don't recall it being so much a eureka moment as a long, depressing few years where I'm, you know, one of my traits as a physicist is I really believe in doing experiments. I believe in measuring everything to see what you can believe. And I would always try and carefully measure what my students were learning, and I knew it. They weren't learning nearly as much as I thought they should be.
Some of them were getting it all, I expect, and others were getting little or nothing?
Perhaps. I would have guessed maybe that some were getting some of it and many others were getting little.
Well, one of the problems you want to tackle is the traditional lecture, 1 hour in a big room, someone standing up the front talking. And what do you want to do instead?
What I want to do is make sure those students' brains are working. I mean, one of the real insights that's come from the last 10 or 20 years of brain research is that learning involves a lot of development of the brain, and just the same way muscles develop by being used strenuously for a long period of time, people now realize the brain does the same thing. And so sitting there nodding off in a lecture is not doing any brain development. So you've got to have those minds working hard during class in order to learn.
I have the same attitude to my listeners. Many of them nod off during this broadcast. So I'm hoping I'm going to learn a few tricks from you. Do you want to teach smaller groups actually in a laboratory rather than larger groups in a lecture hall?
You know, that would be ideal. But what we're learning from really doing careful experiments and designing things and testing them is you can make very effective learning experiences in the large lecture hall, and the economic realities are we need to figure out how to do that, because as you said at the beginning, we have to teach science effectively for all citizens nowadays. There's just too many issues they have to make sensible decisions about.
You're visiting a country where there's more climate change denial amongst parliamentarians than even in the US, and most of them, of course, are sub-literate on science. And yet they're making decisions, legislative decisions, that are going to dictate our survival.
Absolutely, and you know, we have to have a citizenry that when legislators stand up and make some of these really ludicrous claims, people say, you know, that's
ludicrous.
We're gonna vote for someone else.
I like the cut of your jib. Now, I've been reading your lecture notes here, and I'm fascinated by your arguments. You say we need to reduce cognitive load. My cognitive load is feather light, but how would I reduce it?
So in a classroom, every time you introduce a new technical term, you put extra cognitive load on a person. And it turns out that the part of our brain that remembers and processes things on a short time scale, like listening to your radio program or listening to my science lectures, it can only hold about 7 new things. And so if I put in 3 technical terms, I've kind of used up half the mental capacity of that class.
7 new things. I think that's an extraordinarily ambitious notion, but okay. So you've got to simplify.
Well, no, you don't have to simplify, because you have to make the brain work hard. But what you want to do is not waste capacity. And so I want to avoid using some unnecessary technical term so that I can leave you with that extra mental capacity, cognitive capacity, to think much more deeply about the real important scientific issues, as opposed to just knowing a bunch of fancy vocabulary.
You're very user-friendly, because the next part of your argument is addressing beliefs. Does that mean you've got to take into account the cultural limitations or perhaps the scientific bigotries that you're confronting?
Yes. I mean, you certainly have to take into account the cultural background and perspectives. But it also, more than that, it means that you have to realize that people's learning is shaped by that background experience, those values, and the processes by which they're told things. And so if I tell you things as a source of great authority, then you go away thinking, well, science knowledge is just by who claims it with authority. On the other hand, if I instead present you with a detailed discussion of here's the processes by which people came to understand this, you go away thinking, okay, I can make that judgment. I can see the logic of that processes. I can see that data. That's how scientific truth is established. Those are very different messages that one can take away, but that's what happens in the classroom.
I would like to issue all my audience with clickers. Would you explain why?
Yes. This is one of the things where we've seen that we can make the large lecture experience vastly more engaging and mentally active for students, because the clicker is something, it's like a simple television remote control with 5 buttons on it. And so during your lecture program, you could suddenly stop and ask, okay, I've explained something, here's a question for you. And each of your audience would decide which of these possible answers that you've given them are correct, and they would press that button, and you would see right away how many of them understood what you'd talked about and how many of them didn't. Mm. And so then you could go, and if they understood it, you knew you could quickly move on. If they were confused, you could go back, find out what was confusing them, and move much more effectively from that. And
so, I understand you've picked this idea up from a peer instruction technique, which made it easier for the less active or assertive student.
The technique of peer instruction really builds on the use of the clickers and the clicker questions. The clicker just makes them accountable, makes the student feel they have to be answering. But the peer instruction is that you then, before they know what the correct answer is, they talk with the students around them and try to come to a consensus as to what the answer is and the reasons for that. Again, it's getting students thinking much more actively, but it's also getting much more individualized, feedback and guidance in a big lecture hall just from their peers. And so they learn a lot from those discussions.
Have you issued clickers to the new administration? Are they clicking away in response to your suggestions?
No, but it is a technology where the use is growing very rapidly, just because it's simple, inexpensive, and highly effective when used right.
I was telling my little anecdote about my scientific colleague with whom I did a TV series or two, and him saying to me, "Only three people on Earth understand me." Now, in a way, he was talking about fellow scientists just as much as he was talking about the likes of me. You know, I take science on faith. It seems to me that even scientists don't understand each other. How many scientists understand what you do, really?
Very few, because, I mean, it's a different area of disciplinary expertise. On the other hand, I can, partly because I practice and I know how people learn, I can explain it to practically any scientist and so they can understand it.
Is that right, Carl? You're an amazing fella. You deserve a Nobel Prize for physics. Oh, you got one.
No, it's not that hard once you understand more about it's just like taking science. There's basic principles there. Once you understand how people learn, what's needed to help them learn effectively, you just apply those, like conservation of energy, and it actually works.
Oh, look, you're a tonic. I hope it works in the United States and it flows on here. Most things American do flow here, as you've probably observed. So I've been talking to Carl.
Good and bad.
good and bad. Carl Wieman won the Nobel Prize for Physics back in 2001 and the Carnegie Foundation's U.S. University Professor of the Year Award. And even in our brief encounter, I think you can understand why. He currently directs his very own science education initiative, named for himself, at the University of British Columbia and the Colorado Science Education Initiative. Thank you very much, Carl. On our next, I talked to an octogenarian Iranian artist. I flew up to Brisbane to meet her last week at the Gallery of Modern Art. She's quite a girl. See you then. Yeah.